Okay, and welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon on Shake and Wake Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancer Like a Ball. And I'm also on PSN Radio and SoFlow Radio and EPGN Radio. Thanks to Annie and all the other station owners. And I do want to say right off, while I remembered, that all the stations are listener-supported, so please hit that donate button if you are able to. And I had the infamous poopy guy on last week, so he'd been sending me messages for weeks and weeks and weeks, said he wanted to come on, and I was about to finish up that book, so I called him and told him. But now, starting of a new book. I think Annie, I know she put it all around Facebook and all that, and I don't know if she sent out an email or whatever, but this book is by Dr. Judith Reisman. I guess I'll get into whether she's a sociologist or a psychologist, one or the other, but I had her on the show twice before she passed away a couple years back. Okay, an email too, Annie, thank you. It is Sexual Sabotage, and it's a very, very long subtitle, How One Mad Scientist Unleashed a Plague of Corruption and Contagion on America. So, this is a bit of a lengthy book, for sure. At least, let me see. Trying to go through. There's a bunch of end notes. Well, I think it's at least, I don't know. Okay, 338 pages. So this will take a while to get through. Not like the last book. And I need to, well, I'll use something else for a bookmark. I've got a pen ready for the first, oh great. I just lost my YouTube. I had to bring it back up. I have to run a YouTube in the background, otherwise my screens go black. Dark. After 15 minutes. So, I think this first page says, in praise and gratitude, to our moral and honorable Judeo-Christian greatest generation to redress their libeled historical record, and to the United States Supreme Court Justice and Antonin Scalia, who assured me decades ago that authoritative evidence might reverse our scientifically fraudulent sex laws. Mm. Roe v. Wade. Seems like Anton Scalia has some sort of foreknowledge. I'm sure he was pushing it for years and years and years. Who knows? Acknowledgements. By abiding gratitude to my longtime friends Elizabeth and Joseph Farah of WorldNet Daily for their resolute belief in my work and for shepherding this book through to fruition despite its many bizarre trials and tribulations. Thanks particularly to David Kuplian for his consistent encouragement. To my WND editor, Megan Bird, for her friendly, professional, unruffled resolve, and to Katie Clark Vecchio for reducing my behemoth manuscript into a readable size. I am especially grateful to the excellent WND team that made it possible for one more politically incorrect book to reach the great American public, and to my diverse and loyal readers who have informed, encouraged, and supported me for these many years. And finally, of course, to my generous, cherished family, all of whom have succored me through good times and bad. I owe them my balance and my joy. The sound level's okay? Chapter 1. Hate America, Libeling the World, War II Generation. This generation left their ranches in Sully County, South Dakota, their jobs on the main street of America's, Georgia. They gave up their place on the assembly lines in Detroit and in the ranks of Wall Street. They quit school or went from cap and gown directly into uniform. They answered a call to help save the world from the two most powerful and ruthless military machines ever assembled. Tom Brokaw, The Greatest Generation, 1998. All right, thank you. After World War II, it would take roughly 15 years for hedonistic hate America saboteurs to seduce the children of the greatest generation. Picture a 13-year-old boy wearing his Walkman headphones or watching MTV. He enjoys the liberties hard won over the centuries by the alliance of philosophic genius and political heroism. Consecrated by the blood of martyrs, he is provided with comfort and leisure by the most productive economy ever known to mankind. Science has penetrated the secrets of nature in order to provide him with the marvelous, lifelike electronic sound and imagery production he is enjoying. Life is made into a nonstop, commercially prepackaged, masturbational fantasy. The new American lifestyle has become a Disneyland version of the Weimar Republic for the whole family. Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind, 1987. I've had this book about, I don't know, 8 years, and this is virtually the first time I've opened it. I interviewed Judy Reisman twice on the show, and first time I've opened it, so she's passed on a couple of years back. Mother's flags hung in the windows for most homes in my neighborhood in 1942. Walking past them, I knew that when a blue star was replaced with a gold one, another son or daughter had died to protect me and my country. My gratitude and sense of obligation began then, as 416,800 soldiers died. 16 million fought under arms, and millions of stateside Americans shouldered the burdens of war. Little did we know that having survived the enemy forces in Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific Ocean, our heroes would come home only to be sabotaged, betrayed by a cult of American draft dodgers lounging on the grassy slopes of Indiana University. There, strolling along the tree-covered green campus and the undisturbed wilderness of Dunn's Woods, Alfred C. Kinsey, a zoologist, studied gall wasp, taught classes, conducted sexual research, and in 1948 and 1953 published reports that defamed our heroes, their families, and everything they fought and died for. With a cadre of devoted followers, this scientist, in quotations, I don't know if she's probably loosely saying scientist, I think she did when I interviewed her, actually. So, lied about our forebears and slandered the World War II generation as promiscuous, adulterous, homosexual, and even bestial. Abundance evidence proves that these sexual perversions reflected the activities and character of the Indiana University professors, not of our accused World War II fighting men and women. Nonetheless, this false statistical survey of the morals of World War II Americans would be believed and relied upon for generations to come. Indeed, it continues to seduce our nation even today. 1948, when Kinsey's first book was published, I was 13 years old and wholly unaware that my freedom and safety were a legacy granted me largely by unknown women, bred as independent ladies, and unknown men, bred as religion and the spirit of gentlemen. Little did we know in 1948 that the nation's character would be transformed from Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher to that of the tortured youth of the 1948 pornographic novel, Amboy Dukes. We were still being lifted aloft to higher things by the virtues of the founders' generation, reflected in our own World War II parents. In 1948, my parents, like most people on our street, never locked the car or our front door. The paint spray can was not invented until 1949, and graffiti did not mar shops and signs, even on the rough side of town. Stores did not have wrought iron bars protecting their windows. Burglar alarms were rare indeed. In 1948, I walked the mule from my house to Bancroft Junior High School in Los Angeles. My fellow students discussed weekend plans, parties, dances, and church and synagogue events, and were commiserated with several movie stars, children whose parents were divorced and were commiserated with several movie stars, children whose parents were divorced. Okay, that's along the Hollyweird agenda. On Saturdays, I often took the trolley from Hollywood to the beach, where I spread my towel on the sand, searched my lunch bag for an apple, and lolled about reading my book, swimming, and finding seashells. Catching the last streetcar back to L.A., I sauntered home after dark. Some Saturdays I might have tarried on Hollywood Boulevard, peeking in the shops, enjoying an ice cream cone moseyed home in the evening. In 1948, as my friends and I meandered through beaches, parks, and streets, we had no idea of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll that would soon assault us. Like me, Elvis was 13, and John Lennon was only 8 years old. Few kids smoked cigarettes or drank alcohol and drugs. Few kids smoked cigarettes or drank alcohol. Drugs? Question mark. A very sophisticated friend once asked me if I'd take a smoke marijuana. What is it? Question mark. I asked. When she told me, I was stunned. Why would I ever want to do that? Question mark. I chalked up this strangeness to the fact that her father was a film director. Again, we all knew about movie people. through very few kids, though very few kids had cars in the late 40s and early 50s. One nice 16-year-old boy rode a motorcycle and occasionally picked me up after class at Fairfax High School. Of course, he never tried to kiss me. The phrase, sweet 16 and never been kissed, still applied to most girls I knew. We never heard of date rape. In 1948, my parents did not worry much about my safety. They knew I didn't take rides from strangers, and I was a good girl. Even our liberal crowd was not a sexually liberal crowd. Child molesters were considered rare indeed, and though some of those queer fellows lurked about in movie theaters, parents still usually felt their children's independence and freedom outweighed the rare possibility of harm. This was the common reality in 1948. Americans of all races and religions and from most socioeconomic backgrounds tended to share similar morals. In fact, most single men were quite likely to be virgins as adults, including Playboy's Hugh Hefner and liberal CBS newscaster Andy Rooney, drafted in 1941. Rooney recalled his Colgate College football team, saying that none of his friends there had smoked, and we didn't say S blank blank T or F blank blank F. And we didn't sleep with our girlfriends. Sex was only a rumor to us. Former NBC anchorman Tom Brokaw wrote what is perhaps the most celebrated study of World War II Americans in his 1998 book, The Greatest Generation. Through stories, private letters, poems, pictures, and diaries, he documented and summarized their values and ethical character. Brokaw wrote that their morals were as important for victory as were tanks and planes and ships and guns. He thought it would be wonderful to have a statistical study of America's strengths. Indeed, such research would have been valuable. For tragically, the world would soon view a false statistical survey of World War II Americans defining the generation's moral and ethical character. While our fathers and grandfathers fought World War II, and while our mothers and grandmothers, both overseas and on the home front, bore the burdens of war, Alfred C. Kinney did not. Instead, when Americans entered the war December 7, 1941, the 41-year-old zoologist was an Indiana University teacher researching human sexuality, wrapping himself in the mantle of science. Kinsey and a secret sexual psychopath would project his own sexual demons onto men and women, appreciably called the Greatest Generation, the Americans who saved the world from Hitler's National Socialism. Writing on the financial support and seemingly impeccable credentials of the Rockefeller Foundation, the National Research Council said Indiana University, Kinsey published his distorted data in sexual behavior of the human male in 1948 and sexual behavior of the human female 1953. As his fans say, the world would never be the same. With a Madison Avenue advertising blitz, these two reports were expressively marketed and gained credibility as Kinsey focused on the Western world, on the imagined note in the eye of his fellow citizens, rather than on the brain of his own. The men who came home after World War II surely would have agreed with 1960s pop singers Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. Gee, but it's great to be back home. Home is where I want to be. But while these heroes were trying to resume their lives, they would be sabotaged by the submissive barrage, a twisted campaign that informed the world that American men were sexually deviant. Under his assault, they surely would have agreed with other Simon and Garfunkel lyrics. Everywhere I go, I get slandered, libeled. I hear words I never heard in the Bible. Kinsey not only studied sexuality, wrote one of his admirers, he helped create it in such a way that it is difficult for us to recognize what pre-1950s sexuality looked like. True, but while Kinsey's narrative described a period of sexual repression, his statistics claim that the generation was sexually immoral, promiscuous, and deviant. Why the contradiction? As one who was there, I witnessed firsthand his sexual slander of heroic Americans. And as one of the elders now, I have researched Alfred Kinsey for 35 years, finding that he and his cult labeled our World War II warrior generation in order to validate his own cowardly perversions by creating a sexual revolution. Sadly, he succeeded. Morris Ernst Kinsey's... Yeah, thank you, Annie. Sadly, he succeeded. Morris Ernst Kinsey's American Civil Liberties Union lawyer explained that Kinsey would collapse Victorian morality by libeling World War II fathers. Since the whole of our laws and customs in sexual matters is to protect the family and the base of the family is the father, Kinsey would prove is quite different from anything the general public had supposed. Thus, slandering father could gut the laws and customs that protected mothers, children, and the family, and it did. No match for Kinsey's media blitzkrieg, the war generation's humble reticence to talk about what happened gave Kinsey and company carte blanche. Domestic propagandists launched a stealth attack on their own homeland by defaming our heroes as hypocritical perverts. While our fighting men, still in shock from combat, tried to rebuild their lives, war-weary America was bombarded with the highly publicized tale of Kinsey, that Kinsey sold as reality. In believing the lies about the World War II generation's sexual character, our culture would see the hijacking of the hard-earned sexual laws and customs that protected the family, children, and civility. After Kinsey decisively influenced and grievously damaged my society and tarnished the legacy of the generation that saved the world. And as our society takes this slander for granted and allows damage to spiral, Kinsey's co-conspirators continue to terrorize our nation. This is why I track the Kinsey lobby. Our children deserve better. Our greatest generation deserves better. I think I'll mark my spot. I'm going to go off another half paragraph. In 2005, 60 years after the end of World War II, I watched the documentary, The League of Grateful Sons. In one scene, several elderly former Marines stand at attention beside an Iwo Jima graveyard epitaph. when you go home, tell them for us, for your tomorrows, we gave our today Semper Fi. The narrator explains that for half a century, they were silent. Finally, signs of aged veteran, our real history, is being transferred to the younger generation. This is my passion, to transfer the real history about the greatest generation to our heirs and to expose the libel of our finest Americans. It is vital that we clear the reputations of our parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents. The younger generation must know their ancestors have been betrayed and defamed, and understand why and by whom. It is up to us to set the historical record straight. And that's time for the break there, the first break. Let me see here. I guess I'll take about a 4-minute break here, everyone. Be right back. The love of God has been extended to a fallen race through Christ the Savior of all men. There's hope in Okay, let's try this again. Lost about 10 minutes there. I got it all figured out and rebooted like four times. Shut the power to the computer completely off. Rebooted the a router and then rebooted the computer four times. And then I still had to take my pee break. Sorry about that, folks. Somebody didn't like the message, I'm guessing. Who were we before Kinsey? Although black slavery ended with the Civil War in 1865, women continued to live late, largely under patriarchal control for another 55 years. Indeed, in the late 1860s and early 1870s, the new national scandal thrived. Traffic in white female sex slaves flourished in scores of big cities. New York was the center of the commercialized sex in the United States. Child and adult brothels were everywhere, catering to heterosexual and homosexual pleasures. Commercial sex pictures and prices were posted in hotel shops and saloons throughout the city, using alcohol and sex devices to tempt the crowds. Catapulted by the Young Men's Christian Association, YMCA, on March 3, 1873, New Yorkers passed an obscenity statute to try to control the spread of venereal disease and crime. When he moved from Connecticut to New York, social reformer and crusader Anthony Comstock was horror-struck by the visible public traffic in sex. In 1868, he organized a public suppression of vice that resulted in massive arrest and a successful cleanup of New York City that spread nationwide over the next four decades. Markedly casual toward victims of the white slave traffic, sexually liberated psychiatrists and sociologists, educators, actively marketed the sexual freedom advocated by Clark University President G. Stanley Hall. His Viennese visitor, Dr. Sigmund Freud, and their colleagues, thus, just as it does today, the battle raged between repressed pious Americans and the liberated licentious academic elites. By 1910, men increasingly joined the organization of women's movements to end the white slave traffic. In 1917, America entered World War I, a conflict joyfully ended in 1918. By the 1920s, even New Yorkers increasingly lived in a relatively sexually restrained and thus safe and sane environment. This was a culture in which our future World War II heroes were born and raised. But the battle of America's character still raged. Stepping boldly into the fray in the late 1920s, the Catholic Church began a campaign against Hollywood's brazen nudity and sadistic pornographic film indecency. As a result, with theaters half empty, Hollywood studios were forced to hire writers and produce films that fit the moral values of America, of average Americans. This meant hiring brilliant, often very moral writers to produce fluffy, witty, or charming dialogue and good drama that did not run afoul in the new motion picture production code. popularly known as the Hays Code for its creator, Will Hays. Under these highly moral guidelines, Hollywood entered its golden era from 1934 until the 60s. So while F. Scott Fitzgerald described big city flappers kissing, smoking, drinking, and partying, average folks loved Norman Rockwell's small town Americana. Illustrations of naive youths who fished, skipped school, graduated, dated, and married through artistic elites ridicule, though artistic elites ridiculed these images. Even in a wild world, he described, Fitzgerald exposed the modesty of the times when he said that parents worried about their daughters kissing their beau. Kissed, laughed contemporary historian Gertrude Himmelfarb. Bloomsbury, she said of the elitist English blue-blooded wannabes, would have been amused by so quaint a notion of liberation. Like Fitzgerald and Rockwell, playwright Thornton Wilder lived among and wrote about Americans in our town. In his classic 1938 play about Grover's Corner, a boy and a girl grow up as friends, fall in love, marry, naturally as virgins, work, have children, age, and die. Commending the common decency of most of the town folks, our town did not idolize the fictional town of the people who lived there. The play described the basic decency and morality of a typical religious conservative America. Though it did not point fingers, stereotype others, and otherwise divide people from one another, most Americans, white and black, in fact, tended to fit Wilder's description. Trying to turn the pages of a crispy book. Crisp pages that stick together way too easily. Oh, goodness. Certainly having trouble. Wow, finally. With the Great Depression, however, between 1929 and 1932, the average American family income dropped 40%, from $2,300 to $1,500 annually. As people lost their jobs, farms, and businesses, while many also lost hope, poverty-ridden and desperate Americans on soup lines and bread lines held true to their religious and moral values. Survival became the key word. While democracies such as Italy and Germany eventually fell to dictatorships. By 1934, however, while Hitler's corporate leftist National Socialist German Labor Party secretly geared for war, America enjoyed an economic upturn that brought jobs to her 13 million unemployed. Meanwhile, Berlin was in the international center of the sexual decadency that nurtured Hitler's National Socialism. Later, I will address Hitler and his comrades' sexual deviance. Just the opposite there, Dr. Judy. You've been deceived on that. But for now, note that the Nazis advocated a bogus platform of family values. Here at home, the United States did not return to the big city decadence of the late 1800s or of the Bloomsbury effect. By 1939, men who had been on soup lines worked in war factories. A couple of years later, they fought overseas to defend the values that had sustained them during the Great Depression. In fact, between 1941 and 1945, 416,800 U.S. soldiers would die to preserve those values. Joseph Heller, who wrote the classic World War II novel, Catch-22, grew up in a small Coney Island flat. Heller says he and his friends didn't know they were poor. Like most people, they lived with his family until he joined the service, and like my own father and mother, aunts and uncles, he brought his paycheck home for his mother until he enlisted. Women and children walked about most small and large cities, day and night, alone and without fear, without harm, says the observant war reporter and novelist. His New York neighbor was poor but safe, insular, and secure. In the 19 years I lived on the street before going into the Army, I never heard of a rape, an assault, or an armed robbery in our neighborhood. There was just about no fear and violence, and there was practically no crime. Both inside and outside the house, we were safe. There were no kidnappings, no burglaries, and always in decent weather, there were scores of kids on the streets, on the street, to play with. I think that was, I don't remember his name now. Divorce was rare. Nearly everyone had married parents. Some, like Heller and his sister and brother, were raised by a widowed mother. Unwed mothers were rare and therefore seldom seen as disdain or illicit. Sex crossed class, race, and educational lines. Indeed, Heller and his cronies joined the military as virgins. He adds with pride that his married pilot buddies never exhibited even the slightest interest in sex with another woman, not on rest leaves in Rome, not in Sicily, Cairo, or Alexandria. Sex without love still seemed utterly unethical to college men, explained Dutch sexual liberation, sex and law researchers Phyllis and Eberhard Kronhausen, PhD. In 1960, rich or poor, all races and religions tended to share the sexual morality and value of male and female chastity, belittled by the Kronhausens, reported by Fitzgerald and celebrated by Rockwell, Wilder, and Heller. And while the sophisticated elite ridiculed America as sentimental and unreal, America did largely resemble Norman Rockwell's paintings. Maybe that's the same kind of characterization as Barack Obama, a.k.a. Barry Satoro, said, "You people clinging to your Bibles and religion." The greatest generation, God, country, and family. Born in 1940, retired NBC news anchorman Tom Brokaw confirms Wilder's fiction and Heller's nostalgia in his landmark 1998 book, The Greatest Generation. Brokaw interviewed World War II Americans and published their intimate records, revealing their hearts and souls, the values bred into the young men and women who came of age as war broke out. Responsibility and a commitment to honesty, said Brokaw, are the connective cords of their lives. There were certainly expectations by this, but this was a rule. American history is unambiguous about what Brokaw calls faith in God as a singular mark of his generation. Since revolutionary and even the civil wars, the beliefs and of The beliefs and valor of American warriors certainly shaped the World War I and World War II American character. To understand the heroes of that generation, we need to understand their beliefs in God. For despite the current fashion of covering up our religious heritage, masking truth by bearing false witness about American faith defiles both historical accuracy and the American people. Okay, let's try to take another break, everyone. Mark my spot and if I could find my spot now. Yeah, here we go. Let's try to take another break. Or the second break. Come on. I think... Let me see. Find my mouse. I think maybe about a 6 minute break this time. Let's try it again. Be back in a few minutes.
Well, I once was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in. A little talk with Jesus made me whole.
Okay. Seemed to go good there for 6 minutes on the break there. Yeah, Danny, I've thought that way for a long time about all of the so-called holidays. You know, you got the commercialization. Probably comes from the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. Commercialize everything. Nobody bought rings for engagements until 1938. the De Beers crime family invented that. I'm sure with help of the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and all the other commercialized Daves too. It's all about your money. They believe it's theirs, not yours. Always wary of temptation, our founders labored to rear generations cut from the sturdy, unpretentious, and demanding cloth of Scripture. As a result, the World War II generation was trained to honor God, country, and the family, and was thus trained to build a secure life with their children, and indeed for all of us. Faith in God was part of the lives of the World War II generation. Brokaw wrote, "They stayed true to their values of personal responsibility, duty." And let's see if I can change this page. Hey, it went. Honor and faith. Those outside their families reminded them of the ethos of their family and community. Most World War II Americans embodied the strict standards of my mother and father, wrote Brokaw. The parents of my friends, my teachers, my coaches, my ministers, even local businessmen would remind him, "That's not how you were raised." After the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, Brokaw found those strict standards at work. Those who could not serve in the military did everything in their power to help at home. World War II reporter recalls, one World War II reporter recalls, "Men and women alike exuded a patriotic fervor unmatched in history up to that time in the USA. Families saved the lard from cooking and took it to the markets where it was recycled. Ration books were ever present, containing tokens allowing for monthly gasoline and food allowances. Extras were non-existent. Only the bare necessities of life were used." Eager to free their men from combat, women served in the Army Nurse Corps, Navy Nurse Corps, and the WACS, Women's Army Corps. WAVES, Women's Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, and WASPS, Women Air Force Service Pilots. 6 million Rosie the Riveters built tanks, ships, planes, guns, jeeps, and machines needed for the war. Certainly some women delighted in and some exploited their freedom, dancing and partying. However, millions more hurried home to shop, cook, and clean, to comfort, teach, and pray with their children, and often to care for aging parents. Millions wrote to their husbands and sweethearts every night. Most working moms relied on family, friends, and neighbors for child care, with less than a million children in government care centers at the war's end. Our mother's war, recorded the perspectives of women typically of the time. Young brides reassured husbands of fidelity, no matter the war wounds. A wife moaned that after Pearl Harbor, her husband awoke at about 5, looked into her eyes and said, "Listen, dear, I have to join up now." Women habitually downplayed shortages and rationing. Possibly you have been reading of the severe cold and flu shortage, fuel shortage. We are very comfortable, have not had to shut off any rooms. Scores had their babies alone. This kind of looks like Melissa, but it's not spelled the same way. M-E-L-I-S-S-E. I wonder if that's a misprint. Melissa wrote that the greatest hardship, of course, for those who were left at home is the fear of their beloved's safety. Has anybody ever heard that name spelled that way? I sure hadn't. Mary King, a Rhode Island mother, got the worst news possible that her son killed in the last months of the war. Unaware of her husband Frank's death, Natalie wrote to him, "Oh God, I think I'll go nuts if I see you everywhere, every place. I'm so worried about you." I had neither. Yay, Rhode Island. On June 6, 1944, a million American soldiers abroad, 4,000 ships, began landing on the Normandy beaches. About 10 weeks of combat, American forces had driven the Germans from almost all of France. D-Day was the beginning of the end for the Third Reich. As the valorous Allied invasion of Europe defeated the Germans, who unconditionally surrendered by May 1945. Brokaw's own wake-up call came in 1984 while filming an NBC documentary about the 40th anniversary of D-Day. Recalling his trips to Normandy Beach in France, he said, "I had come to understand what this generation of Americans meant to history. It is, I believe, the greatest generation any society has ever produced." Emphasis added. Like our founders, the greatest generation did not glorify war, but rose to the occasion and become heroes and heroines. Robin, a regular G.I. Joe, wrote about his D-Day experience at Normandy. His poem, Longest Day, includes this telling excerpt. Sorry about that. Had somebody ask me a question. Includes the telling excerpt. "Do not call me hero. Each night I stop and pray for all the friends I knew and lost. I survived my longest day. Do not call me hero. In the years that pass, for all the real, true heroes have crosses lined up on the grass. The New York Times book review described Brokaw's Greatest Generation as a tribute to the members of World War II generation, to whom the Americans and the world owe so much. Biography magazine wrote that we owe the Americans of the 40s our freedom, our very lives. The Times added, "We who followed this generation have lived in the midst of greatness." The Daily Press of Newport News, Virginia, wrote that the greatest generation was made up of brave men and women who quite literally saved our skins. And documentarian Ken Burns extorted, a generation of remarkable Americans are better angels, indeed. But after the war, our weary warriors didn't know what hit them. Alfred Kinsey claimed to have studied them, and when he reported that nearly all American men are our better angels, were actually sex offenders, though he also claimed that no women or children were harmed by rape or incest. Really. Kinsey's saboteurs claimed that most pregnant single women, many are soldiers, sweethearts, who worked so hard to support the war effort, had supposedly aborted their babies en masse. He alleged that half of the women and the vast majority of men had engaged in premarital sexual intercourse, most without regret. According to Kinsey, the men were not only promiscuous. Most, he said, had supposedly used prostitutes. About a quarter had engaged in homosexual acts, and horrifyingly, a significant number of fighting men who came from farms had actually committed sex acts with animals. These are the boys who married their sweethearts in droves to enjoy precious days or weeks before they went off to defend their ethical heritage. Contrast Kinsey's image of our war generation was the recollection of Tracy Sugarman in My War, a love story in letters and drawings in which he reminisced about his relationship with June, his college love. How young and innocent most of us were. For most of us in the 40s, we were in love. Romance and fantasy was the best we could manage. It was still hell having to wait to make it legal. Tracy and June married so they could have a few legal months together before he joined the Navy and shipped out. The pledge of their love shimmers through every snippet from his letters. And this is a snippet here. There is such a hell of a lot I want to show you and tell you. Nope, distance doesn't make my heart grow fonder. It just lets me show what I've been looking at all along. And it's a lovely thing. A wonderful, adorable wife. You've given me enough luck and happiness to keep me intact for a dozen wars. I love you, Junie, with all my heart and soul and might. God bless you, wife, your adoring, happy husband. The Sugarmans were joyful, meaningful, married for over 50 years. James Dowling wrote from a German POW camp to his girlfriend, Dorothy. Dearest Dorothy, I am all right, sweetheart. Don't worry about me. We'll get married as soon as I get home again. I love you and miss you terribly, sweetheart, and wish I could be with you soon. I have lots to tell you when I get back. Brokaw says James and Dorothy Dowling still have that love note. Not sexy, not hot, but sweetheart, darling, dearest, honey, wife. Chastity before marriage and faithfulness within it. This is what sexuality looks like, according to many typical World War II men. Disciplined by their military training and sacrifices, our World War II generation married in record numbers. Yeah, baby boomers. Boomers. This was their ethic. In the war, in the hell of war, of course, people did not always live up to this moral code. But it was always their ideal. The marital picture Kinsey painted, however, is a lesson in contradiction. In Kinsey's world, almost half of all men and a quarter of women committed adultery. Extramarital sex in Kinsey's parlance before they were 40 years old. Worse, he claimed that a quarter of wives had aborted their babies without complications. Does this really sound like the Americans who saved our skins? The men of honor who fought for our country and the women who devoted their lives to their families, the war effort, Question mark. Marine Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel John A. Butler's last words in a letter to his wife and son typify the best of our men's values. Babe, I am leaving you with four small children. The living testimonials of this love. I have a great faith in them, babe, because I have faith in you. It is so important that they know, love, and serve God, and respect the integral dignity of all men. It is goodbye for a little while only, babe. I always loved you. Yours forever, Johnny. Ladies and gentlemen, is the next section, the title of it. On public transport, most males automatically gave up their seats to the elderly women and children, and men and older boys commonly held open the doors for women, old folk, and children. They would commonly offer to carry a girl's parcels or books, should she wish, before seating themselves, men commonly held the chair for ladies to be seated and waited to eat until the ladies had begun. Men asked permission to smoke and were especially careful to use decent language in the company of women and girls, who were called ladies and young ladies. And a gentleman always defended ladies in any other encounter. I just thought of something. I think it started back in the 40s with the movies. They started calling women broads and dames. Maybe it started before then, but I remember some of the James Cagney movies and some of the other actors that did them. Gangster movies. I don't remember some of the names now. That's the only one I can remember. Patriarchy had many drawbacks. If one's male intimate was alcoholic, violent, or a slow. But the flip side was the male view of men as obligated, respectful, and the service of the female weaker sex. That's right, Mom. So, whether Cagney was the only one I could think of. I still don't remember half the names. In The Complete Gentleman, Brad Miner, a former literary editor of National Review, discussed American chivalry and gallantry. I'll say plainly that the American Republic was funded by gentlemen and depends upon their gentlemanly ideals for both its prosperity and its posterity. Our republic, in fact, I got a little excited there because one of my screens went blank. I thought, don't you do it again. I'll say plainly that the American Republic was founded by gentlemen and depends upon its gentlemanly ideals for both prosperity and its posterity. Our republic, in fact, is the gentleman writ large. It's all about balance and restraint. Miner supports this concept in his discussion of the Titanic survival rates. when even the healthiest gentlemen gave their lives to secure the safety of women and children of all classes, despite the claims of the feature film, Titanic, upper and middle class men, Miter wrote, had the lowest rate of survival on the Titanic. On the other hand, men who were not reared to be courteous, to be gentlemen in service of ladies and children, often sink to the level of scoundrels. To paraphrase Voltaire, a belief in and fear of God are especially important for those in authority. They must fear a higher authority who sees all that they do and who will meet M-E-T-E never seen that word our eternal punishment. Otherwise they may do whatever evil pleases them. Voltaire also warned, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. In 1948, Kinsey, the antithesis of a gentleman, caused millions to believe absurdities about the sexual morality of the greatest generation. Predictably, restraint slackened and sexual atrocities followed and have skyrocketed. But as our boys recovered from the ravages of World War II, the ethos of family and community supported faith, fidelity, personal responsibility, honor, and children's innocence. In the sight of Comstockian success, New York City's Central Park welcomed couples and families who were unafraid and unaware of the misery and crime that had blighted the city a few decades earlier. In 1948, a safer, saner, softer, and superior society was visible to the naked eye. Cities that had once been vice-ridden saw women and children enjoying the freedom to casually roam streets, paths, and beaches. These venues were created because America's character supported public areas where men, women, and children alone or otherwise could safer wander day or night. Today, however, these once congenial places of public recreation are again vandalized centers of crime and cruelty, unsafe after dusk. The compromise is stark. The sex industry had been thwarted. The vice squads... you know what? I'm going to take a break first before I get on to this section here. Let's see. I think about almost a 5-minute song. Be back in a few minutes, everyone.
Gloria and I wrote this back in 1963. Back when your mom and daddy were just courting, right?
Just courting. Yeah, right.
watch me sing. Oh, he touched me. Let me hear you sing it. Oh, the joy. Oh, the joy. Something happened.
Something happened.
He touched me.
Okay, and welcome back. About the last, 25 minutes or so. This really was who we were before, during, and after World War II. This is the generation that I knew as a child. This was America, an extraordinary nation that came of age during the Great Depression, and two world wars, and went on to build the greatest modern society the world has ever known. And these are the men and women, our fathers and mothers and grandsires, grandsires, our heroes, our heroines, whom Kinsey claimed to truthfully revealed in Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, 1948, and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, 1953. A generation that was sabotaged by a deviant pseudoscientist who libeled our legacy and screwed our societies. Still in the first chapter. No, I'm sorry. Chapter 2. The Kinsey Reports as Sabotage. It is probable that half or more of the boys in an uninhibited society could reach climax by the time they were 3 or 4 years of age, and that clearly all of them could experience such a climax 3 to 5 years before the onset of adolescence. Alfred Kinsey, Male, Volume, page 178. How did the world come to see our greatest generation as sexual hypocrites? Going into battle, many a soldier carried a photo of his wife or sweetheart, and with it, he carried the palpable fear of her possible abandonment. In all wars, the chastity and loyalty of women back home is critical to soldiers' morale and fighting spirit. Soldiers who doubt this fidelity begin to question the value of risking their lives to defend their wives or girlfriends and their country. So suggestions of infidelity are an effective and universal war propaganda tool. I'm trying to think of her name. The woman that did the radio programs in Japan. Was there something Jane? Is that what her name was? I forget. She used to say a lot of stuff like that. Your girlfriends in your life, they got boyfriends or other men. Why are you fighting us? Somebody remember her name? I've forgotten. I thought she called herself Jane something. Alfred Kinsey took a page from World War II playbook, capitalizing on the seeds of doubt planted by the war propaganda, copying its method of sabotage. On both sides of World War II, psychological warfare received huge sums of money. A 1943 Life magazine article revealed that the Office of War Information trained over 300 newsmen, radio and printed technicians, and others in propaganda. On the other side, 80% of Italian prisoners, the article said, had PWB, Psychological Warfare Branch, leaflets in their possession or had read them. We now know that most soldiers on all sides were exposed to Tokyo Rose. That's who it was, yeah. You must have Googled it, huh, Annie? I don't know why I thought Jane. I don't know why. Tokyo Rose. I've heard some of them recordings because they used to record her. And, that's okay. On both sides of World War II, psychological warfare received huge sums of money. A 1943 Life magazine article revealed that the Office of War Information trained over 300 newsmen, radio and printing technicians, and others in propaganda. On the other side, 80% of Italian prisoners. Okay, I read that. We now know that most soldiers on all sides were exposed to propaganda, including sexual propaganda. White propaganda encouraged white positive propaganda encouraged soldiers to stay clean, strong, and to return home as healthy and honorable as when they left, despite the reality that some fighters did have sex abroad amid the ever-present possibility of death. On the other hand, black negative propaganda was counterfeit and information made to look like helpful warnings from the soldier's country, seemingly obligated to reveal information about promiscuity at home. Such propaganda often claimed that wives and sweethearts were being unfaithful for the benefit of American GIs. Tokyo Rose and Axis Sally infamously broadcast tales of stateside betrayal. Our surviving warriors confirmed the historical record. Axis Sally liked to tease and taunt the soldiers about their wives and sweethearts back in the States. "Hi, fellows," she would say. "I'm afraid you're yearning plenty for her. But I just wonder if she isn't running around with the F4s way back home." I'm sorry, the four F's way back home. Such broadcasts were hurtful and to be sure, but Allied soldiers easily saw through these enemy productions. The most pervasive and effective black propaganda strategy used venereal disease health education campaigns. According to the extensive body of wartime literature, such as World War II U.S. Medical Research Center, venereal disease was a concern. Propaganda seemed to destroy the morale of the enemy by charging in leaflets dropped from airplanes that wives and girlfriends were having illicit sex and being infected at home. To increase their power, these materials regularly used credible-looking but invented scientific statistics, as Kinsey's oft-quoted reports would later demonstrate. People believe numbers, even if they are phony. For example, a Nazi flyer that was dropped on English-speaking Allied soldiers claims that 20,000 men investigated a staggering proportion from venereal diseases. Over 80% had VD. The flyer alleged that of infected women, 21% were prostitutes. Of the rest, 61 were pickups, 18% were girlfriends, 17 were girls under 20 years, and 84 were wives of men serving in the armed forces abroad. These false statistics defamed women and confused soldiers, damaging the men and their families. As this extract from the soldier's letter suggests, "Honey, I don't want you to get mad when I ask you this question. Is there somebody else? If there is, tell me." In another snippet, after several paragraphs of sweet chatter to her soldier at war, a woman responds to such a suggestion. "I didn't like that remark you made about me taking guys out in your car, hon. That would be a dirty trick, I think, Henry, dear." During World War II, seeking ways to demoralize enemy troops, the Axis and the Allies alike slandered their enemies' wives and sweethearts back home as sexually promiscuous. After the war, Kinsey repeated this libel against American wives and sweethearts. It worked. How did this battlefront in the war affect our post-war culture? Could it have planted seeds of doubt and roots of jealousy that caused divorce rates to spike after the war? Perhaps a more lasting legacy may be that Alfred Kinsey was able to capitalize on the domestic effects of this damage. As Axis lies, may have tweaked our view of American culture, made us more likely to receive scientific fiction as fact, and set up for Kinsey's campaign, tearing down America's dearly held ideals and faith in chastity and fidelity. It is entirely probable that World War II propaganda prepared the way for Kinsey's campaign and provided models for his crusade. Just a few years hence, Kinsey's fraudulent publications would strongly resemble the battlefield propagandist booklets, incomplete with purported scientific data. The end of one war, the beginning of another. On August 15, 1945, Japan surrendered. After almost 4 years of war and a year of pre-war preparation, it could take years before all 16 million soldiers staggered home. They never suspected that they would soon face another war, waged by the group of American draft dodgers, armed with their own domestic form of black propaganda. Few veterans spoke much about their service, laboring to remember the best and forget the worst. The repatriated warriors commonly experienced sudden, terrifying flashbacks and sleep disturbances. Post-traumatic stress shell shock was common. Some stammered for the rest of their lives, trying to overcome the traumas of war. Men made trips to military hospitals, sometimes frequent, often useless. Every American city and hometown was shaken. Men and women struggled to find jobs again, earn a living, finish their educations, and restore their health, families, farms, and homes. The separations and shocks of war changed everyone, taxing even the most mature and committed. Husbands and fathers struggled to get to know their families again, or for that fact, the first time. Children had grown without the control of their fathers and often resented the discipline Dad needed and expected. The men worked to repair broken down homes, relationships gone rusty, or just gone after the 4+ year conflict. Divorces increased. Many whirlwind marriages by poorly matched couples trying to grasp the future before the boys shipped out. Would soon collapse. The post-war years also brought dramatic increases in marriages and births. Having cheated death, many returning vets cherished life and got married immediately. Births jumped to the highest in our history. The population increased by 12 million between 1940 and 1947. With the unprecedented baby boom, and by 1950, youngsters under 15 would be the largest single population group in the country. Adding to the trauma facing returning warriors, the polio epidemic that had begun in 1916 surged into the 1940s and 50s when the disease crippled tens of thousands of children every summer. In 1952, there were 59,000 new cases of polio. It was hard for people today to imagine the terror of a veteran who came home to the specter of his children struck down in the seemingly random disease. In fact, a paralyzing fear documents families fleeing their homes after children in their neighborhoods were infected. Victorious in battle, the greatest generation knew who they were. Faith, loyalty, honesty, and patriotism were their defining characteristics. But overcome by the need to get back to their feet, on their feet, to regain their health and sanity, they hunkered down. In doing so, they largely failed in one crucial area: to guard against domestic propagandists who would defame them and their values and their descendants. And so these heroic warriors could not defend themselves from a new insidious enemy: the draft dodgers, domestic traitors, and elitists who had avoided war, who had stayed safe at home, and who would soon inflict their immorality on the rest of us. No, our heroes did not see it coming. A new war at home was about to assault the victors of World War II. Before the Welcome Home Joe banners had yellowed from the sun, a post-war twist on black propaganda punched the greatest generation below the belt. In January 1948, a mere three years after the war ended, nearly every mainline American newspaper and magazine burned with headlines and quotes from a book that had hit colleges and bookstores. America's men, sons, fathers, and husbands were allegedly amoral and abnormal. Then, with a 1-2 punch, Kinsey scored a knockout. In 1953, he launched Sexual Behavior of the Human Female, adding scientific statistics that American women, wives, and mothers, according to Kinsey, had survey proved by the men and women of our greatest generation were, as Ben Shapiro put it, secret perverts, and sex maniacs, and worse. Kinsey stated it was very clearly, said Charles Sakharidis, M.D., that all types of sexual activity, sex with the opposite sex, sex with the same sex, sex with both sexes, sex with children, sex with whips and chains, fisting sex, sex with animals, any kind of sex was normal and common. Aleister Crowley, do as thou wilt. I'm sure he was a big influence of Kinsey. I'm quite sure. I wonder if she realizes that. A brief review of Kinsey on sexual behavior in the human male. When Americans read sexual behavior in the human male, they invariably envisioned their own husbands and fathers, mostly hard-working, sacrificing family men, whom they had presumed to be faithful and heterosexual. With far-reaching consequences, Kinsey's creepy statistics ate at the younger generation like emotional poison. The greatest generation was slandered in the name of science. According to Human Events, Kinsey's initial report stunned the nation. It said American men were so sexually wild that 95% could be accused of some kind of sexual offense under the 1940s laws, while 37% had at least one homosexual experience, and 47% of college men did so to orgasm if they were still single by the age 35, since most normal American men were married by age 35, this allowed Kinsey to suggest 47% of men were sometime homosexual. As though these were normal males, but there was more. The report described American men as undeniably corrupt, claiming that nearly all American men violated sex crime laws. A majority used prostitutes, many performed homosexual sodomy to orgasm, and more than a few had sex with animals. Sexual behavior in the human male made the following claims. Ninety-two percent masturbated to orgasm, page 499. 67-98 had premarital sex, page 552. 39% at the college level performed premarital oral sex on a woman, page 371. 68% had premarital coitus by age 18. Page 549 and 552, including table 136. Sixty-9% of white males had at least one experience with a prostitute. Page 597. Marriage and adultery. 49% performed oral sex within marriage. Page 256 and 371, college sample. 50% of husbands were adulterers, labeled by Kinsey as extramarital acts, page 585-587. Homosexuality, 10-37% sometimes committed homosexual acts, page 650 and 651. 14% performed and 30% received homosexual oral sex with climax at least once, page 373. Nearly 46% engaged in heterosexual and or homosexual activities to or reacted to both sexes in the course of their adult lives, page 656. I think I will mark my spot there, everyone, and call it for today. I have to make dinner. So I'm going to play a little something that somebody mentioned earlier, if I can find it. Oh, here it is. Hope everyone enjoys this song. And see everyone tomorrow for me and Roger.